You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
Before we start, I have a couple of housekeeping notes. The Second City has gone from stage to screen and really everything in between. Our live shows in Chicago will be resuming on May 7th with limited capacity in our main stage theater. Look for our other stages to open up in the coming weeks and months. We're also resuming some live in-person classes, corporate shows, and learning sessions. We continue to have virtual offerings in all these areas, as well as hybrid offerings. You can get all the information you need at secondcity.com.
Welcome to the world of Tony Ho from CBC Podcasts. It's an award-winning, bite-sized narrative comedy series about human relationships, familiar, hilarious, and sometimes unnerving. The troupe features Miguel Rivas, Adam Niebergall, and alumnus of the Second City mainstage, Roger Bainbridge. They will take you on a darkly comedic ride that finds honesty in every situation. You can listen and subscribe to Tony Ho on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Oh, I love this conversation with Judy Samuelson. She is a founder and executive director of the Aspen Institute Business and Society Program and a vice president at the Aspen Institute. She's had an amazing career, and she has a new book, which is called The Six Rules of Business, Creating Real Value in a Changing World. Enjoy the pod.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Applied Improvisation at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, seeking connections, and finding a better way. This is Getting to Yes And.
Days can be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The coin on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Judy Samuelson, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
This was such a timely and interesting read for me. Second City is actually being sold for only the second time in its 62-year history. So I've been immersed in all these financials and discussions of the sale. And then you have the COVID-19 pandemic, among other influences, that's opened many people's eyes to the incredible inequities that exist in the systems that help run the various marketplaces in this country. And a chief culprit for this seems to be shareholder capitalism. And your book talks a lot about this, right?
It does. So it is the most important question in this design question we have here. Yes.
Yeah. So is it all Milton Friedman's fault?
No, can't blame him. He's long gone. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. We kept him alive. What can I say? It's a design of companies. It's the questions that start with why are we here? And what are our intentions? And then those myriad ways in which we create decision rules and design incentive systems and elevate some ideas and make other ones hard to, you know, give room for because of traditional ways that we think about success. And so, you know, it's Milton Friedman, but it's also, as a colleague at Harvard Business School, Lynn Payne, that I write about, says, it's also the scaffolding that keeps Milton Friedman in place.
Right. I mean, we do a lot of work at Second City with the behavioral science community. And what we've learned is, I mean, these incentives, I mean, people will go where they're led. And in particular, you talk about the real cost of that. And the examples are like what happened with Royal Caribbean Cruise Line or what happened with Volkswagen, right? These people, sure. The incentives were there to have the behavior be bad.
Right. They didn't, of course, intend for it to be bad. And I'm very clear that one of the myths that I like to break open here is that business is not it's not good or bad. It's not moral. It's not immoral. Business is just a stew of ideas and intentions, but that how they're reinforced by, you know, the design of the enterprise and what we hold dear and what we encourage people to do. And then that produces good and bad results. So I'm not saying that those good and bad results shouldn't be assigned back to the enterprise. Of course they are, but I also like to think that a different design could have had a different result, and that's important too.
So I know we can't go in depth on all six rules, but I do want to touch on each of them because I think they're all important. And rule number one is reputation, trust, and other intangibles drive business value. How is that different than maybe how businesses perceive themselves in the past?
Well, it's been a pretty profound change during the period of time that probably both you and I have been, in our careers. And that when I first started out working or went to business school and then went into banking, the measure of the measure was something you could put on your balance sheet. It was a bricks and mortar and how much you had paid for this and that. And then designing, looking at future cash flows and discounting them back and adding it all up and implying certain rates and all that. None of that is relevant when your value is really made up of intangibles like mm-hmm. reputation and trust. How attractive you are as an employer. Are you able to attract the talent you want? Are you getting people to put their shoulder to the wheel? Are the employees engaged? Do they know what they're there for? So those are not things that you can measure easily. And they're not things that it's easy to make simple comparisons between companies, which is the other thing that the kind of financial markets want us to do.
We had the academic Carl Bergstrom on the podcast, who has a book about bullshit. And he quotes this anthropologist, Marilyn Strathern, who said, quote, "When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure." And I thought it was a really, really great, simple way of talking about what you're talking about.
Yeah, I've got another one that I'm going to try on you here that I don't know him. His name is Jerry Muller, and he teaches, I think, at Stanford. He wrote a book called The Tyranny of Metrics. And he says, I have it right here on my wall. I pulled it down to read it. Metrics lose their meaning when used to reward or punish performance rather than to diagnose and analyze.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What are we doing? What are we trying to do by measuring?
Mm-hmm. That's great. And you introduced me to a concept I don't think I certainly understood once I got into it, but externality. Which is the costs imposed on a third party who isn't part of the transaction. And it was such an aha moment because I'm like, oh yeah, I don't think people think about those folks, but that becomes crucial, especially now with social media.
Yeah, it absolutely. And social media is a part of why we no longer ignore them. It's also the capacity of NGOs, nonprofit organizations working globally mm-hmm. and seeing the consequences of decisions at the end of the pipe, and realizing the only way to really drive the change is to hijack a brand. It may or may not be a bad actor. It may just be the one who is rolling up a lot of protocols and practices in a massive supply chain and, attaching their brand to it. And so, but you don't change it without harnessing that kind of buying capacity. And so a lot of changes happen because of the targeting of a Nike or a targeting of a Shell, or, we could come up with McDonald's. McDonald's has been targeted more times than, I want to count. That doesn't mean they're the worst actor. It just means they certainly have responsibility for a massive system. And it's a lot more efficient to work with one entity like that that has a direct financial relationship through the chain than to try to do it from the bottom up.
And you do have one example I want to talk about, because last week I ran out to my local Starbucks to get an iced venti Americano, because that's my drink. And I was a little surprised when the barista handed me the drink without a straw. And then I remembered that they actually stopped offering straws a few months back. And then, yes. And then I'm reading the book. I'm like, oh yeah, this happened to Starbucks.
This is it. Thomas Kamei. I write about him. He's one of our fellows, and he was working at investment fund Cornerstone within Morgan Stanley. And that became a real issue. You know, he calls it a gateway plastic. You know, mm-hmm. it's just the beginning of the conversation in a more complex set of things that are not priced right. Right. Mm-hmm. That the market hasn't responded to the bigger problem. And so you start by making one piece of it reveal the more complex ways in which plastics in this case have become a real scourge on, you know, consumers. And, you know, again, we're not going to fix this one consumer at a time, as much as I try.
Yeah. Well, the other example, and you cite Roger Martin's work a lot, but this whole NFL example, which I didn't realize. Talk about that.
Yeah, it's a great example. Roger Martin, who I've known for years, but to stand as a dean at Rotman at the business school at the University of Toronto, he makes the analogy. He talks about the NFL and he says, you know, in the NFL, we don't allow anyone who touches the game, player, the team doctor, the owner, the manager, we don't allow them to bet on the outcome of the game in Vegas. Those two things are kept totally separate. But what do we do when we pay executives? We put the outcome of the game exactly at the center of the betting on the outcome of the game, betting on the stock market, which is a different market. The stock market's an aftermarket. You know, you got, as to quote Marjorie Kelly, who wrote The Divine Right of Capital now decades ago, but first started speaking about this, you know, you got your money at the IPO. Why are we continuing to reward the investor as if they are the real risk taker? That is certainly not the case when you're talking about a market as developed as the stock market.
So let's talk about rule number two, which is businesses serve many objectives beyond shareholder value. There's a line in the book that just stuck out at me, which is purpose is an input, profits are an output. Again, this is this new, and you talk a lot, I mean, this is storytelling, right? We have to, you talk about this, but we need to change the story. And that's why I think having this sort of language that is simple, but provocative and changes our view is really important. So talk a bit about that, about inputs and outputs.
You know, one of the, I talk about two different men who have advised our company or our enterprise at the Aspen Institute. One is David Langstaff, who was a CEO of a company called Viridian that he took public. The other one is Bill Budinger, who with his brother, Don Budinger, founded Rodell Electronics. And they both have aspects of ways they talk about this, but I'll talk about the way that Bill talks about this, where he essentially says, you know, profits are like oxygen. Of course you need them. But it's not why you get out of bed in the morning. You don't, you know, employees don't get out of the bed in the morning to breathe. They get out of bed for something that they can connect to. And increasingly in this day, in this, you know, age that people talk a lot about the influence of millennials in the workplace. But I think it was true for baby boomers. We just weren't brave enough to talk about it or didn't have the benefit of social media and the anonymity that, you know, is created through social media. But basically, people want to know how work connects to how they live. They want these worlds to be connected. And so, you know, back to the question of purpose, you don't create an enterprise with a single objective function. It just doesn't work. It's too complex than that. And the best managers, of course, are multitasking all of the time. They're not putting one objective on the wall and making everything manage to that number.
Yeah, and we had a guest on the podcast who had a great section in their book, which was examining the various mission and vision statements of different companies. And you explore Boeing's in your book, which is not good, kind of confusing, and it shows that's a problem.
Yeah, you talk about that. One of the things to talk about is that purpose is actually revealed by the enterprise in terms of how they make decision. And that Boeing is a sad story in that case, because what was revealed, it was all about beating Airbus. And that was covering a lot of problems.
Mm, okay. Rule number three, corporate responsibility is defined far outside the business gates.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I talked about that a little bit with the, you know, examples of these massive enterprises whose brands are at risk, right? They're all about reputation. And, but they also have tremendous influence. And I write about Jason Clay, who essentially looks at all of these commodities that are used in consumer products, in food, and that are, like palm oil, which is it's not something I go and buy at the grocery store, but it's in hundreds of products that we probably have in our, you know, refrigerator or closet or, you know, cupboards. And how do you link the need to reconnect markets in a way that it doesn't pay, that deforestation to create room for palm oil doesn't pay? And so the only way you do that is to actually move way up the food chain and figure out where these kind of commodities that are disrupting the natural ecosystem on which we are wholly dependent, how do you price that back into the system? And so, you know, he identifies, you know, the dozen or so companies that you need to capture in this web of reconnecting decision-making back to the long-term health of the ecosystem on which we are all fully dependent. And I know that sounds complicated. There are lots of examples of how that happens, and there are lots of examples that are playing out in real time that we can continue to learn from. But it does mean finding the right kind of players inside companies who are either brought to the table, you know, kicking and screaming. I write about Phil Knight of Nike, but boy, once they get religion, they actually can really drive real change. There are other companies that have always been ahead of the curve. You know, I talk about Levi Strauss. I think they're one that's just kind of was built into the family legacy, and they've always had a thoughtful approach to how they make decisions and how they play out in communities way beyond our view.
Yeah, you had an example of something they did, and I don't know if I put it in my notes or not, but it was they figured out that they were using these chemicals for distressed genes, and then they found out they could have the same effect with lasers.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's tremendous.
It's a great one. Yes, another one of our fellows, his name is Bart Seitz, and he kind of grew up in the denim industry and, was serving, his family business was supplying Levi Strauss, and then he ultimately got drawn into other markets, and Levi Strauss convinced him to come and be an innovator inside the enterprise, and he's done remarkable work. But he's not alone. You know, it's Levi's has a culture of real value creation. And they have for a long time. They were the very first company that said, you know what, in this world of all of these complex decisions around human rights that are way outside of the view of most of us, the best thing is to be totally transparent, that this is, and let the market in a way hold us accountable by not keeping our suppliers secret from one another. You know, you don't want to tell somebody else your best supplier because, you know, maybe they'll come in and reprice you out of access to that particular manufacturing enterprise. Instead, let's go totally transparent. So people, we have sight lines into the performance of our supply chain. And, it was a very novel idea when they executed on that one as well.
Well, I like the term you use inside this chapter where you talk about corporate fitness, because that implies something that is not like it happens and it's done. You know, it's like you don't go to the gym once, you know. And so this idea of if you want to be fit, you have to kind of work at it really every day or you know, every other day. And that is I guess that's one of these new rules, right? It's not a way that I think people traditionally looked at their businesses, especially successful businesses, you know, because it's very easy just to keep going as you've been if you're doing well.
Yeah, but it's an interesting one because I feel like with almost all of these rules, they're not really new.
Yeah.
they're rooted in our knowledge of how to build great businesses. And this kind of corporate fitness is very much like the quality movement. The quality movement is decades old. You know, it grew rapidly in the United States in the 1980s when it was picked up by GE, you know, from the military, which had learned it in Japan. And there's this long story of how the total quality movement and what we measured as a result of taking this approach. But an important principle there was really empowering your own employees to keep an eye on, you know, the factory floor and make sure that we reported up the food chain as soon as there was a problem. But it's the notion of continuous improvement as well. You are never, sustainability is not a destination. Mm-hmm. It is a, you know, it's an idea and we're constantly managing to it and we will never totally achieve it because of course the conditions change and we're constantly having to refresh and think differently about how to embed ourselves into these living systems.
Yeah, I mean, and this pandemic is, you know, it all changed. I mean, I've worked at a live theater company that does live comedy shows and live corporate training. And, you know, in middle of March last year, we turned around and became a media company that does shows and training using these mediums, you know, Zoom yes. and otherwise. And we had to dig in, but we were able to do it. And part of it applies to the next rule, which is rule number four, which is employees give voice to risk and competitive advantage. When we had to do this pivot, the people who did the pivot were our employees that we're working with that were like, all right, let's figure out how to do this and get, you know, I mean, and, you know, we turned to that group, a much smaller group than we had previously, but we were able to do it and by working together. And there was no hierarchy at that point.
You know, years ago, we brought a group of our fellows to Second City mm-hmm. for one of these leadership exercises. It was a really great, okay. day and a great visit. But, you know, employees are our allies. You know, they're not a cost. They are the enterprise, you know, they're the face of the enterprise. That's one of the things we've learned from COVID. We're reminded just how, you know, what makes up a company, you know, who are these people? And it's kind of humanized, I think, companies in a way that hopefully we'll continue to lean into.
It's, you know, but and it's important to, I mean, we've known this Second City creatively, which is like, for many years, I hired all the talent, and I would often say if I was being interviewed, you know, I'm hiring talent to disrespect me because we're a very anti-authority kind of institution that is, you know, taking on the man, and I was the man at that point. But, you know, these internal change agents, it's tough for them because they, you know, it's people don't want to hear, a lot of corporate leaders don't want to hear what's wrong. And that strikes me as something you're also talking about here, that it's important for companies to listen to these people.
Yeah, absolutely. And if they don't, watch this space, you know, I mean, we've seen two remarkable events. We've seen a lot of remarkable events in the last few weeks, but I was thinking about the, you know, the decision of these 220 employees at Google who announced the formation of an employee union. Mm-hmm. And we'll see, you know, we'll see what happens now. I don't know that this story is fully told. And, you know, earlier this week, there was an announcement of Amazon employees doing something similar. In the case, I don't know the Amazon example as much, but what was fascinating about the Google employees, it wasn't just about their own self-interest. They're inviting in contractors, mm-hmm. you know, people who are on the other side of the cubicle who don't have the same wages and benefits and protections. That's an act of courage if you're a contractor and you join that union.
Right.
You know, because that might guarantee that you don't get on the payroll of the enterprise. So, you know, this is a dynamic space. I think, however, it's a time of change at the leadership of companies. And I think the best ones are listening well. And I think there's a lot of examples of CEOs that are doing that better today.
Rule number five, culture is king and talent rules. And one of the things I want you to talk about inside this particular section is the why. And an example is basically COVID-19 in the stock market.
Yeah. You know, you can't understand the stock market if you're living in the country right now. Yeah. Like, it's saying a couple things. One, very few people are benefiting from the bulk of the run-up in the value of the market.
Right.
You know, something like 50% of Americans hold stock. Of that 50%, only a tiny, tiny fraction have more than $100,000 in the market. So there's winners and losers. And the winners, you know, it's a winner-take-all kind of a feeling. It's not feels like it's really benefiting shared prosperity. I know we all, anybody who hasn't is happy to see the market go up. It's one of the reasons it's a bizarre test about the health of the economy itself is simply disconnected. One has nothing to do with the other. Again, back to Roger Martin, it's just trading in shares of stock that come with certain rights and benefits, but it's not the enterprise itself. It's disconnected from the health of the enterprise and certainly from the well-being of the employees who inhabit the enterprise.
Yeah, I mean, the income gap is crazy, and the fact that people are the value of what looked like Elon Musk has been making, and then recognizing all these people were out of work, all the people getting sick.
Yeah, it's interesting because I mean, you know, he's just surprising me. It's like, why is it worth this much? I saw the statistic the other day that if you take the valuation of Tesla and divide it by the number of cars actually produced by Tesla, it's 1,025,000 per car, 1.25 million per car. For GM, it's $9,000.
Right.
Right. It's like, what are we measuring, right?
What are we measuring?
Where is the value? At least he's making a product that's critically important.
Yeah. I was really happy to see the new rule, number six, because chapter four of my book, Yes And, is all about co-creation. And rule number six you have is co-create to win.
Oh, great.
What I talk about in our book is using improvisation. We develop our shows with our audience. We ask what's on their mind. We improvise scenes. They laugh or they don't, and we adjust based on that. And we do that over this like 12 or 13 or 14 week period. And we've been doing that since 1959. Other people might call that crowdsourcing, you know, or other more contemporary terms. Yeah. And you add other wrinkles in here when you talk about co-creation. We're doing it in this 12 week period, but in the case of like Bryant Park, it's going on over just decades.
Right. You know, everybody who has a stake in the enterprise is the most important people to have at the table. But when that's the Bryant Park example. You know, Bryant Park is right in the, you know, it's a jewel of a park right in the center of, you know, New York City and Midtown. And when I moved to New York, it was, you didn't feel it was safe to walk into this park. And today it's one of the most populated parks in the world. Mm-hmm. That was a long process of trial and error. But the kind of management of this enterprise, which is fully in the public interest, was about, you know, making a better front door for the enterprises that, you know, touched on that park surface. But, you know, there's a lot of examples of business leaning in. What's different now is when the system itself is at risk. Yeah. You can't solve these problems one firm at a time. You simply have to be putting aside comparative advantage and thinking about how you create, co-create, collaborate to tackle the health of the system first and foremost. And, you know, you see it in fisheries and the changing protocols that tie an industry together. We're seeing it, you know, with McDonald's role in addressing the beef industry and looking at what the protocols will need to be to kind of clean up that industry. There's a lot of compelling examples, but the one that we're coming out of right now, or not out of yet, but let's look at the creation of these vaccines. And these companies actually learned from one another. They broke the code together and they worked in partnership with the government. And let's give credit to the Trump administration for some protocols that helped move more quickly than usual.
Yeah, we've been talking about this a lot at Second City because it's much smaller right now, but we're also, you know, all in our homes. And this idea of getting the right people in the room and recognizing who needs to be at the table, because, you know, Michael Slaby is a friend of mine, and we've had him on the podcast. He's a tech guy, and he's always advocating, and this is well before COVID and when we all turned to tech, but he's like, get your tech person in the room because they're going to be a solution provider at some point. And if they're not early in the room, that's going to be problematic. Right.
Comms people say the same people, right? Same thing, right? Communications people always say, get your communication strategy as part of the design of what you're trying to do.
But it's hard because you just like, you want to have a big tent, but we all know that you get too many people in a room and nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a lot of science about this out there in the nonprofit sector, you know, people that have tackled complicated things like, you know, housing and, cleaning up a shared, cleaning up the Great Lakes, you know, that kind of thing. Like, who really has to be at the table, and how do you then bring other kind of circles to the table over time? But, I've worked with a lot of partnerships over the 20 some years that I've been doing this work. And the great ones, the great partnerships is when there really was a complementarity between you and the partner, and you needed each other to move further, farther, faster, and to have a bolder vision. And, I'm not so sure that enterprises that are like, kumbaya, let's all get together and create this together. If it's not real clear why, your purpose, your intentions are, fully aligned, I think, it ends up feeling like a lot of extra baggage. And, people are tackling very complicated things. It gets revealed over time, but it often starts with somebody who has real knowledge about how to build enterprises, build partnerships, and is listening deeply and almost is the artist behind the front, line, who is maybe going to end up getting credit for it later on. But there's an art and a science to building effective partnerships to tackle real complex problems.
Yeah, we at Second City, we talk about building ensembles. And so the ensemble is responsible for creating the show. And an ensemble, the thing that's unique about that is different people will come in and out, but the sort of rules of behaving as an ensemble, those stay. And those are, where you listen to each other, where you have each other's back, where you make the other person look good. And when you have these diverse ensembles, that's the best because, everyone is sort of learning from each other and bringing their sort of different experiences and creating really unique content. And the way they're able to do that is because they have these sort of rules of the road that have been, sort of taught to them and have been taught to all these performers for decade after decade. And, we always joke about this at Second City because we go teach other companies about this stuff and, we got to get better at teaching it back to ourselves. I think that's going to be sort of a goal for when we reopen. But it's not easy. And as we pointed out before, the work is ongoing. It never stops. And
that's fascinating. Fascinating. I love that. I love that analogy. I talk about the craft beer industry. Mm-mm. Their real desire is to grow everybody so they can have maybe bigger market share in what had been a different, kind of more of an industrial style of delivery. And we're seeing that a lot, right, in new markets and kind of the kind of systems you see the green markets build in where they kind of collaborate on promoting each other and kind of hang together during this period of time to make it easy to advertise and use each other's capacity, online and beyond. And I think there's a lot of interesting examples, and they almost have a shared, it's what you're saying, there's a shared ethic. There's a belief in the ultimate product, which elevates all of us. It's not about my performance versus your performance. It's not just, my beer is better than your beer. Of course my beer is better than your beer, right? I mean, I know that. But we share and learn from one another to build an enterprise that is truly generative.
Mm-hmm.
Creates opportunity for all of us if we master it.
Yeah, Sid Finkelstein at Dartmouth was on the podcast, and in his book he explored that idea with chefs, starting with Alice Waters, developing sort of other culinary stars who then move on. And that happened, Grant Achatz here in Chicago. And it's interesting because that industry seems to cut either way. You either have the tyrant chef, or you have the ones who are looking to have you, like, please go on and do great stuff and make a name for yourself.
Yes. Slow food is another example of that. You know, Corbett Coomer's book about slow food is a wonderful one to look at in that domain, because, again, this was a radical change in how we thought about, creating food together. You know, it was like, no, it's not about it's the opposite of fast food. It's about the experience of being together. It's about the culture of it. It's about the community we create through careful, cooking and eating, right? So it's about the community that you build. And I think it's very exciting. I think it's why so many young people are drawn into these industries today.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. We always end the podcast by asking our guests for a yes and story. So in the parlance of improvisation, you get nowhere by saying no. And you actually don't get that far by saying yes. You say yes and, you affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. Do you have a yes and story for us?
I do have a yes and story, and it takes me back to how I first started doing this work. You know, I was at the Ford Foundation running what would today be their social, you'd call it their social investment program. And I was presenting to the board of trustees that has these kind of corporate titans on it, mm-hmm. Hank Shack from Cummins Engine and David Kearns from Xerox and Chris Hogg from Reuters and Bob Haas from Levi Strauss. And they started essentially saying, why don't we ever talk about business at the Ford Foundation? And, we stepped into that question. I had the support of the soon to be president of the Ford Foundation, Susan Beresford. I didn't have the support of the division heads, who thought the idea of the Ford Foundation working with business was actually a pretty scary thought. They thought we would not be better off, it might be worse off if we stepped into this. But Susan kind of heard this as a mandate, and she invited us to get creative with it. And so we were able to say, let's develop an answer to the trustees, but let's go deeper here. Let's really use the resources of the Ford Foundation to go deeper on this question and understand the case examples of business operating differently and what we can learn from them. And let's also then start to amass the players who were already starting to work in this domain, the trade associations that had started to bubble up, places like Business for Social Responsibility and Students for Responsible Business and these other enterprises that were bringing together people of a like mind. And with the resources of the Ford Foundation, we could help them on their kind of journey and connect with one another and start to build the places where businesses that were well-led could kind of retreat to talk to one another. And so it was an incredible moment, and I'm lucky to have been at the table when these questions got posed.
Yeah, and it led to the writing of this book too.
It ultimately led to the writing of this book, which has been a long enterprise, and I'm grateful to have been able to talk about it with you.
The book is called The Six Rules of Business, Creating Real Value in a Changing World. Judy Samuelson, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor and producer is LF Garris. We get support at the Second City from Jenny Crowley, Abby Bumbledare, Mike Farinaccio, and Colleen Fahey. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. If you have questions, guest ideas, or if you want more information on working with Second City Works, you can go to www.secondcityworks.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
survive.